sun, little darling, here comes the sun. I say it's all right, it's all right. Here comes the sun.
Welcome to Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. This is your host, Eric Mann, with your producer, Jenny Martinez, and the great help of Mark Maxwell. Today we're happy to have a conversation with Blaise Bonpain, who's celebrating his 87th birthday. And apparently every year they make a big deal about your birthday. I think they're just happy you're alive and, you know, glad you're part of the movement. So I look forward to next year at the 88th and so forth.
Wow.
Blaise is director of the Office of Americas. He served on the faculties of UCLA and Cal State Northridge. I know him, and we all know him, with the Office of Americas, his own show on Pacifica World Focus. And in particular, I remember you, Blaise, in the past, in the very high visibility role in the struggles about Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and of course, we want to talk about today. So welcome to Voices from the Frontlines.
Thanks very much, Eric, man. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, Blaise, let's start with, when was the first time that you figured out you were a revolutionary?
I don't know that I ever figured it out, but certainly when I got to Guatemala and saw the presence of CIA and Green Berets secretly involved in a war there, oppressing the indigenous people, who were the majority, and developing a propaganda, basically, that declared that every poor person in the country was a subversive. Well, I think that that led to a very dramatic change in my perspective and my understanding of U.S. foreign policy. And that policy really hasn't changed much since the days of the intervention against Guatemala back in 1954. I was expelled from there in 1967.
Did you consider the concept of imperialism?
Oh, yes, very definitely, because ever since the end of World War II, we've been engaged in failed operations which have taken the lives of some 30 million people. This has been one of the great holocausts of the world, taking place in Korea, Vietnam, all of Latin America, and now horribly in the Mideast. This is a cultural problem of the death of empire, the death of a culture, and it's taking place before our eyes, and at this time it's leading toward a nuclear disaster for which we are paying $1 billion for our own demise at this time. So we're in a state of really a social psychosis, a very serious social psychosis, and a religiosity known as American exceptionalism. That is our religion. It's a development from Manifest to Destiny of the old days of the 19th century and even before. Well, so we're in a very serious situation. In the midst of it, we're beginning to see a beautiful realignment, which has nothing to do with political party. Realignment means people begin to think in a different way. And we saw it with Occupy, and we've seen it with Black Lives Matter, and we've seen it with the development of candidates who can talk about democratic socialism and so on. This is all a new development. It mainly depends now on the people to continue the realignment to where it should go.
Well, you know, Blaise, I don't feel as optimistic. I come out of, as you do, the anti-imperialist movements of the 60s. I was shaped by that. I was an organizer for both CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, and SDS, Students for Democratic Society. And there, in particular, white people on the campuses were explicitly pro-black, explicitly pro-Vietnamese. I don't think Occupy is pro-black. I don't think it's pro-Vietnamese or Third World. I don't think Bernie is pro-black or pro-Third World. And I think a lot of the white kids who are fetishizing, they have a fetish about Citizens United and about money in politics, but they don't really care about Third World people because I'm in L.A. I'm organizing the black and Latino community. I haven't seen one Occupy kid. I haven't seen one Bernie kid. So I'm saying that because I do have hope, but I think part of the hope plays is that you represent a point of view and I represent a point of view that I think we have to do more challenging of these young people about a third world orientation.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. Our founders in their, you know, wealth and power and maleness, even in that, were concerned, at least some of the more progressives were concerned about the tyranny of the majority. That is, if 51% of the people could at least tolerate what was going on, then we really don't care about the other 49%. And the more imperial members figured, well, we don't want mob rule. And they considered having everybody get into it to be mob rule. So we're in a situation now, I think, where we do have a tyranny of the majority and, of course, a control by less than 1%. But maybe 50% possibly of the people will tolerate things as they are. But we're seeing the enormous number of suicides among 40-year-olds. And that's really a very serious thing. People are despondent. So that's another component. All of this, though, does not depend on a candidate. My God, candidates come and go, but they can give us the ideas that must be carried on. And the fact of racism is just incredibly strong. I mean, we generally, except in a case like Yugoslavia, generally bomb people of color. It's utterly awesome how the Koreans, the Vietnamese, the people of the Middle East, this is really amazing. The racism is still there. It's like they say in Spanish, la mala zacate nunca muere. The evil devil grass never dies. It just keeps growing and growing and growing.
That's right.
So we have to realize that, understand it, and deal with it.
Blaise, a couple of thoughts. I think I'm going to start with Christianity, but I want to come back to psychosis seriously and depression. I just finished a book called Katrina's Legacy, The Black Nation and the People of the World Confront the U.S. Imperialist White Settler State and Its Genocidal Climate Crimes. And when I was working on the book, I do trace back the ecological crisis to what I'm calling white Christian European feudalism, capitalism, and imperialism. I see a continuity there. Of course, they're different stages of class society, but they all have in common moving from class exploitation to genocide against Third World people. Now, you've been inside the Christian world trying to figure it out. Do you think that is an accurate assessment of the role of Christianity in the development of capitalism?
I don't think there's any question about it. We have to put our books together because mine just came out this week on Amazon about Christendom and war. The word Christendom refers to the sum total of nations in which the Catholic Church was established as a religion of state. Now, this went on for centuries, together with the just war theory, which was a great fraud that has just been dealt with at the Vatican within the last week, and most of them thought it was a fraud. In other words, empire has a war. It is a just war, isn't it? And you better answer yes, or you might be declared an infidel. So this just war thing has even impacted our troops today. The Catholic chaplain that I recall at Quantico was saying, well, over half the Marine Corps is Catholic. You know, well, so what? I mean, where is the cry for nonviolence? Where is the cry for humanity? This concept of Christendom was built on you either believe what we say is true or we will kill you. And that is basically the message of ISIS today. It's a mirror image of Christendom. And we had popes in charge of some of the greatest battles that were ever fought. The Battle of Lepanto, for example, was called by Pope Pius V in 1571. And we defeated Islam there, and we said that was, you know, because of God and the credit to the Virgin Mary, and it's now celebrated as the Feast of the Holy Rosary. And that was a military thing, absolute savage slaughter of Islam. And we look at the militarism of Christendom, the Crusades, the conquistadores, the Inquisition. You are not free to be in error. You are not free to be a Jew. You are not free to be a member of part of Islam. So I called it the Nicene Heresy, Christendom and War, Reverence and Critique. And reverence means that you revere other people and that you have the critique of existing institutions like an institutional church. And you do not just sit there and take the idea of a just war and use it to kill any group of people in the world.
Let me hold you there. I want to go back to the last punctuation. Is that okay?
Sure.
About the concept of the just war. You know, obviously, 1492 was, I'm not the first person to figure this out, but both the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and the beginning of the genocide in the Americas, and you're the officer of America, so you know all about this. Tell me what was going on in 1492 inside the church.
Well, the Pope Alexander VI split the world into the control of Portugal and Spain. That's why we have Brazil as Portuguese-speaking, and we have much of the rest of Latin America as Spanish-speaking. And in spite of the fact that he made that great decision, the kings of Spain made the choice of bishops. They would send names to the Pope, and they ran the operation. But it was a genocidal operation, and leading to the Revolution of 1810 in Mexico, the Spaniards were fighting on behalf of keeping slavery for the indigenous people and separatism for the Spaniards. And Father Hidalgo and Father Morelos, in their Grito de Dolores, said, no, we want to mix the races. Mestizaje. We want the race to mix. And they had as their banner Our Lady of Guadalupe, indigenous, and the Spaniards had as their banner Our Lady of Remedios, both the same virgin under different titles, fighting each other. Spain in the name of Christendom, and the revolutionary Hidalgo, the priest from Dolores in Mexico, fighting under the banner of Guadalupe. So the racism part has been there, and it was also true with our Constitution. We knew that Britain had outlawed slavery long before we did, long before there was the United States. And we did not. And that led immediately, ultimately, to a civil war, which took 600,000 of our people. So we should have outlawed it in the first place instead of hanging on to it. But they did hang on to it. And things got worse right into the 20th century after the Civil War.
Well, let me ask you this, Blaise. I mean, first of all, it might be fun to do a joint book event, seriously, and have a conversation with you and me about the role of both of our thinking. But in any case, I am excited about your book. Tell us the name of the book again.
The Nicene Heresy. That's N-I-C-E-N-E, referring to the Nicene Council of 320 A.D., which was called by the Emperor Constantine. He had one Roman Empire. He wanted one Roman church. And then he agreed, we will have one Roman church, and the bishops were invited to the council, and they accepted this. Then they put the symbol of Christ on the Roman shield, but the symbol was put on there in Greek, the key and the row. And the idea was, from that time, muscular Christianity began, that you will become a Christian or will break your face. And that's more or less the message that went on from there, leading to the Crusades, leading to people being slaughtered because they were Jews or Islamic or members of animist religions, and leading to papal bulls that, God bless the National Catholic Reporter, a wonderful newspaper out of Kansas City, and they published some of these papal bulls saying, enslave these people. You know, do not let these haters of Christ continue. They are to be basically treated as slaves. And people. That's how Father Sarah and others were good company men. They were following the papal bulls. They were doing what the boss told them to do, as members of corporations do. This is what we do. We take these people, and they can become one of us, or they can be cast off.
One thing on that is, I think the concept of muscular Christianity is great. Let's move back to the present, your own work. At this point in your life, I mean, I'm certainly doing summing up of my life and where do I want to be right now. I'm sure you do a lot of thinking every day about what's the point. You know, these are hard times. What do you think is your role, your specific role right now? Are you doing thinking about that?
Oh, I do. I think of it all the time. And whenever I can, I'd love to walk down on the beach. And my concentration is on one grain of sand.
That's great.
And that pretty well represents the place of our planet in the universe. And maybe to a lesser degree, as they say in Spanish, mi grano de arena, the little grain of sand, I can contribute to make things better. So I see the smallness of it all, and yet I see the importance of will, as the great Gramsci said in Italy when Mussolini was reigning. And Gramsci was an honest man, and he said, you ask me how I feel intellectually, I'm totally pessimistic. He said, however, I have an optimism of the will. And that is what drove him. You continue to drive for what you think is correct in the midst of the disasters around you. He was dealing with Mussolini fascism, and you continue pushing, and every now and then you see some light. I don't know what brings about evil. St. Paul called it the mystery of iniquity. I have no idea how iniquity comes into it. But I know in the liturgy, and see, I really enjoy these liturgies. I enjoy so much of the traditions, but I think we have to make the critique when we need to. All during Holy Week, there is a theme that goes through the idea of people lying and then believing their lies. What happens with an institution like the Pentagon? You create all these lies. ISIS came right out of Fallujah, and we're fighting today, thinking we're going to pacify Fallujah. It's in today's New York Times, you know, that the Iraqis will not fight, and they're not fighting. They're in a state of mutiny. Which reminds me of Vietnam, where our troops were in a state of absolute mutiny. So there comes a time where even the troops say, enough. We're Iraqis, we represent the Iraqi army, and we don't quite feel like fighting in Fallujah, a Sunni city in Anbar province. And you can come over as advisors, as you did in Vietnam, but I don't think we're going to fight, and we're not fighting.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's go back to the grain of sand.
Yeah.
You. Where is this grain of sand named Blaise Montaigne at 87? What are you trying to figure out? Stay within yourself.
Sure, okay.
What are you trying to figure out?
Well, I'm trying to realize that I need a nap.
So do I.
I'm trying to realize that I am not as mobile as I was to get all around the world to different places and to understand that and to enjoy it. To know that this is part of diminishment, but at the same time, I'm so happy to have such an amazing media outreach, both through social media, occasionally through television, frequently through radio, and sometimes getting those calls from the Movement for Accuracy in Media from Washington. And having the office to be a source for them. So our outreach is probably greater than ever, while physically we tend to diminish as time goes on.
I'm a big believer in naps. I work very hard, but then sometimes I just crash and lay right on the floor of my office like...
Oh, I think it's critically important for your health to realize that. You don't drive yourself to a point where you can't even think clearly anymore. You just say, let's take some time off. And I know my daughter was asking me about that the other day. She said, well, she's a physician and so sometimes works 24 hours straight. And she's saying, well, is it lazy to lay on the grass and rest? I said, of course not. It's not only not lazy, it's essential. Well, when are you going to get a new idea unless you give yourself time to get a new idea, to have something come in that connects A with B and B with C and gives you a new perspective?
When I wake up in the morning, I go through a deep, first a psychiatric reevaluation of where am I, what drives me, what did I do wrong yesterday, what did I do good, what's going on with me, where am I really going? Then I do all the political ruminations, where's the world going?
Yeah.
And then I go to work in the specific intervention of my grain of sand. And I do, just for a minute, I'm working on my autobiography. It's very early. But it's funny, Blaise, because I was thinking about the grain of sand. I was sort of saying, well, I was born as a grain of sand in 1942.
Yeah.
And the reason I grew to be, frankly, more than a grain of sand is I was smart enough to join organizations.
Yeah.
Otherwise, my life would be meaningless.
Right,
I joined the Congress of Racial Equality, and then I joined with all these other amazing... They weren't just grains of sand, let me tell you. There were some serious boulders there. And I became increased by surrounding myself with black, very militant, very dedicated, very thoughtful people about telling me... Do you know what the United States is about? Do you know the whole story of the Indians? Do you know, so forth. So thank you for that about the grain of sand. I want to end with this. Fidel, and I'm going to read his whole statement. He just issued a beautiful statement that I'm going to read called The Cuban People Will Overcome. And it's a perfect, in some way, segue into this wonderful conversation, Blaise. But I want you to have a few minutes on this quote from Fidel, because you already said it. Perhaps, however, the greatest danger hanging over the earth today derives from the destructive power of modern weaponry, which could undermine the peace of the planet and make human life on Earth's surface impossible. I know you and Fidel are close, at least psychically. You're thinking about it. Tell us what you're thinking about.
Well, I know in my first visit to Cuba, we're in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s and so on, and here is this land and the leadership under an act of war for over 50 years, and they've given us the best medical care in the Americas and some of the best in the world, and they can produce education for free and we can't. So they've been, Fidel will be remembered as probably one of the major statesmen in the history of Latin America, because primarily because of courage. You know, hundreds of efforts to assassinate him, daily assassination by the press in the capitalist world. They had no idea what they were even talking about. And criticism constantly and urging people to leave to come to a rich country. Here, Cuba is a poor country. It's still a poor country, but has accomplished so much. The idea of lifting people from misery to frugality is one of the greatest possible steps that can be made. And if that requires rationing, so be it, because frugality means you have time to study, you can get a degree, and you live simply. Misery means you can't do anything, you can't even be a human being. And that's what we've condemned much of the world to. Capitalism, with all of its efforts over the years, has left the world as a very hungry, diseased place that is on the verge of a nuclear disaster, where there will not be people living here and watching us spend $1 trillion of our budget, our hard-earned tax money, to improve biocidal weapons that will destroy the human race. We have to get with it. We need this realignment of all of the people of all colors everywhere to say that this mental illness has to cease. The Germans did it beautifully. They denounced the Third Reich and would tolerate no more of it. And we have to denounce our Holocaust that has taken place since 1945 to the present.
Well, that's a wonderful way to end. I just want to end mine with saying that when I was in college, the Cuban Missile Crisis began, and I was a definite Democratic Party liberal, but I still kept saying, but we have weapons, the United States has weapons in Turkey. What's wrong? I don't get it. I am not afraid of Cuba.
Yeah.
And Cuban Revolution is one of the great achievements of human history, to be 90 miles from, as you say, the genocidal colossus, to have built an amazing society, and for people in the United States to say, well, I support Cuba, but I have a lot of criticisms. I think, are you out of your mind?
God, we're running on the same island, a torture center, and we complain about their human rights situation. We have a level of civil liberties in the United States. Civil liberties are not human rights. The civil liberties don't build a home for the homeless of Los Angeles. Civil liberties give me the right to open my porno shop. Well, that's nice. But human rights are entirely different.
Well, preach on.
Of education and health care and the right to be a human being.
That's a great end, if I can say, my brother. Preach on, Brother Blaze. You know, you're 87. We'll both take a nap and then we'll come out fighting. Okay?
Thank you,
you're
Eric.
A very fine brother. You got still a long way to go, my brother, so we need you.
We'll see.
One of my favorite grains of sand.
Thanks so much, Eric.
All right, you take care of yourself, Blaze.
Will do.
Bye.
Bye-bye.